You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. You're listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 LPFM. And we are very pleased to have with us poet of many, many talents, Molly Tenenbaum, who has lived in Seattle for some time, have you? Yeah. And so all of these journeys where you did residences, the Hedgebrook and the Helen Rehoboth Whitley Center, these were journeys that you took to other places, or are they also local?
Oh, those are Washington. The Whitley Center is in Friday Harbor, and Hedgebrook is on Whidbey. I travel a lot. Well, not anymore. I don't go anywhere, but I do travel to the South, like to North Carolina and West Virginia, for a lot of music things. But...
yes. Oh, one of her talents is that she plays old-time banjo and fiddle and guitar. And we'll do lessons even, right?
On
Zoom, as we're doing.
Yeah, lots of online lessons right now.
These days. But she writes poems with great frequency, I take it. She gives readings. She teaches writing classes and workshops. It says in her website that she encourages poetry everywhere. And I would mean probably any time and anywhere as everywhere. Her books are quite an ample collection of work. She has some chapbooks, but her recent one is Mytheria, also one, The Cupboard Artist. Now is the title of another one, By a Thread. And she's published poems in many poetry journals. But not to be forgotten is this unusual work, Exercises to Free the Tongue. And it seems as though this was connected with your grandparents' life as ventriloquists when they did vaudeville in the early 19th century, I take it. Do you want to tell us a little about that, how you dealt with exercises to free the tongue?
Okay, I will. Okay. So my grandfather came when he was a very small child in 1902 from what was formerly part of Austria but is now Ukraine. And when he was a teenager, just he saw an ad in the back of the comic book, Learn How to Be a Ventriloquist. So he did that, and he went on the road in vaudeville starting when he was about 19. And then at a certain point, he met my grandmother. It was this handsome Jewish actor coming through town. She lived in Louisville, and so they got married, and he taught her how to be a ventriloquist. So then they had an act together, and they were on tour basically till about 1925. At that point, they had two kids. The oldest one needed to go to school. And then the youngest one was my dad, who needed to be at home, I guess. And so they pretty much were not professional after that.
But, did they live enough for you to meet them? Did you know that?
Yeah. I was 11 or 12. My grandfather died when I was about 12. So, and they had their figures, their ventriloquial figures were around the house. They did little shows like at senior centers and schools and fundraisers and things like that. And I did not learn. My grandfather wanted to teach me, but I was not a good student, so I didn't learn.
Oh.
I mean, I wasn't a good ventriloquist.
You weren't good at the ventriloquial aspects of the art weren't very easy to pick up then. Would you read some of your exercises to free the tongue?
I will. All right. These two are a pair. And what you have to know is that There are some consonants that are easy to say in ventriloquism, and then there are some that are hard to say. And so for the hard to say ones, you develop these workarounds. And for the easy to say ones, you just, no problem. So I wrote a pair of poems where one would be easy for a ventriloquist to perform, and then the other one would be difficult. So it'd be more for a more advanced ventriloquist would have to perform it. So basically, the ventriloquist is starting his act and he gets on the stage, and this is how he starts it. So this one is called Easy Oration Greetings. Hello, you rustics and roses, you candle lighters, dough eaters, cradle rockers, and rug sellers, you. Raise your eye arches, knuckle your zooks, restrain your hats, and clutch your horses as I shudder these eyelashes, aerate areas, tell trials and anecdotes, turn the joke on the hand, on the stick, under this coat. He who's tacking out talk, his digits on keys, who does he think he is rolling these eyes? Isn't his dad calling? Can't he dunder to his study, don his desk, retire to his inky old dots? You have to think of that as the dummy talking. Okay, but that's only the middle of the poem. The second half, still the dummy's talking. Because, of course, the ventriloquist can say whatever he wants to, but it's the dummy who's limited in how he speaks. So, I hunger to get you alone, you ginger cake, you snickerdoodle. Such a night, the air like heated cognac, and such lunescence roundly glisters that I itch to say the giant L, tear this toy shirt, declare naked heart. Oh, honey croissant, though the internal aorta lunges, though these kissy gesticulators assignate, his don't. So I can't say, knocking hand to chest, that this lance, this thrill, soaring to alight in you, originates here in, sadly, I lack a nascent noun. Here, darling, conjure all that's red and rushing. Under the curtain, our hearts are yours. You sing it, our secret chord. And then the companion is the difficult speech, welcome. So again, you imagine that the ventriloquist gets on the stage and he says hi, and then the dummy starts speaking. And so this would be very difficult for the ventriloquist to have the dummy say, come all you periwinkles and brilliantines, carpet weavers and voluptuaries, lift your tympanums, brandish your vegetables, pinch your caps, forestall your equipoise. Betimes I virtuoso and hypnotize, unmoor my intimate diva, pop my marrow, and offer this humble fantasia, my solfeggio and psalm. Oops, I'm tongue-tubbed. Before your very louvers, my vintage but glimmers. Carpentered, I'm back to first cube. Behind my fast gasp, flat effervescence. My friends, I'm unbearded, I'm all a clam. I've invited my best bosom forward, but dear loves and alarms, fops and beauties, for this furbelow, I'm mute.
Wow, that's diction that people really have to pay attention to.
I know it's hard to hear, probably just going by really fast, but I took all these phrases, like hold your horses or throwing rotten fruit at the actor, and then I tried to rework them into that language. So forestall your equipoise is hold your horses, and in the easy oration, it clutch your horses.
As it goes, it is a quite high-level poetry in the turns of phrase and the sound, the music of it. Very musical. And I think that the poetry does actually come through in that expression as you read it. So how it is through the ventriloquist's somewhat closed, clutched mouth is another thing to imagine, right?
Right? Or a P.
Right, without the explosion. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, without putting your lips together. Because the ventriloquist can't, when the dummy's speaking, the ventriloquist can't
put the lips together.
Very good. Would you like to choose one of your poems to read of recent vintage?
Okay. I'm going to read. Now, one thing I should say is that when I have trouble writing, like, for example, when the world is too much with us that I cannot even function, I just kind of have a habit or an exercise that I do, and I write a poem about poems. I write meta poems instead of actual poems because that's just what I can do. So you might imagine that these days it's really hard to focus. So I went, well, okay, I'll write a meta poem. So there's a bunch of meta poems in my life, and here's a recent one. This poem is socially distant. This poem turning aside to wash its hands. This poem singing man of constant sorrow to the tiny ticking of lather. This poem in all its ballad ornaments trills on a single syllable, ensuring cleaner fingernails. This bleach poem wiping down its keys. In the deeps of the lock, does the shine of the key scrub the inside of the keyhole? This aloe poem for soothing the cracks in this detergent poem busting the organism's oily shell. You never will know what this poem had to say to you, this poem with no body language, no near heat, this poem with a placeholder video background. It might have reached right in to clot your heart. This poem for now letting you keep your initial resistance, this poem no longer pushing through its own. This poem in all impossibility of safety. When you and your kids on bikes spread across the whole street, this poem stood still, face to the rock wall, stone crop dripping purple and lime. This poem in gloves, sorting for the apt image. This poem offering no beverage. Bring your own. Each line a banner of data. This poem's rising numbers. This poem in the voice of the governor's jolt. Every number's a death. Your sister, your brother. I'm sorry. This poem is out of yeast and rye. This poem texting from down the block. Check your porch, I left you sourdough starter. This poem with the wrong kind of everything, it's what they had. This poem logged in late to the cocktail concert. This poem dependent on tips, exposing the faults in the system of artist compensation. Did you know it takes 1,000 streams to add up to just one purchase of an album? This poem has never before needed a cable to shave the delay. This poem almost, but not simultaneous, not nearly close enough for the music to groove, for the beat in the pocket, can still go out in the garden from which it brings the report. Poppies blooming, peas on the trellis, half up.
Now, would you call that in some respects an exercise from which you could cull many different poems or especially lines that you favor as you read it another time? Would you do that?
You mean, would I edit it down? Probably.
No, not edit it down, but pick from it, glean from it. Ideas that are there. It's a long list of ideas for poems.
Oh, I guess it is, yeah. I mean, oh, I wish I could think of the title. I was thinking as I was writing it about a poem by David Wagner, whose title I do not recall, but it was like the poem speaking and it was walking up to you on the street. And it was like scary. This poem is gonna like really force you to look at stuff. This poem is gonna end up right in your face. So I was just sort of thinking, keep it distant.
Yes. keep it distant, right? And though there was, I don't believe, one mention of people masking, there were certain references to the sadness of every number's a death and so on, which we've become so used to in the news as a catalogue of, well, horrors for some people in their lives. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was, you know, the actual news I remember in one of Inslee's press conferences. Because, you know, it's all about numbers, numbers. And he just stopped for a minute and he said, I want you to remember something really important. Every number is a death. I mean, he said that. So I went, yeah, remember that.
But you do call this, in your meta-poetic way, a make-do mask poem. What a good phrase that is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With the wrong kind of everything. Well, that's what they had. Excellent. Yeah, how these thoughts have come to you in quite a long list of ways of expressing what a poem might be. Yeah, very good.
Yeah.
And then, as so often, we think, well, we can always go out in the yard and putter around and see how the vegetables are doing. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, I'm lucky enough to have a garden that I can walk out and just like, okay, I'll just, there's always a weed to pull. There's always something you can do out there.
There is. And how have you chosen to occupy some of your, say, active time in this seclusion, besides thinking of poems and writing those down? What have you found to do?
Well, I mean, I'm working. I still have a job and I teach at North Seattle College. And of course, I'm teaching online right now. And fortunately for me, my class was already scheduled to be online. So I didn't have to totally change everything about how I teach. It was already set up. And but anyway, we're nearing the end of the quarter and students are writing essays and I'm trying to help them write good ones, and everybody's just insanely distracted and trying to deal with the world, and we're all hanging in there trying to help each other. So that's kind of what I do every day. And then I have music students too, and so for music students, I've really been trying to research more and become more knowledgeable about the African American roots of the music I play, which I already knew a lot about. But, you know, I try to really make that part of every lesson lately.
Yes. And have you found any interesting insights from your students' work in this particular time, because it's so unusual?
Too early to say. Mm-hmm. We're all in the middle of it. You know, everybody's dealing with stuff. So.
And is it possible that they're incorporating some of this strange stuff that's in their lives in some of those essays you'll receive?
Well, I kind of hope not, because that's not the assignment. But
oh, okay.
For another assignment next week, I hope they do.
All right. So
I'll tell you next week.
Uh-huh. And the Zooming is not so new to you then. You have practiced it.
Yeah, I have music students who live in many different places, and I've been teaching them for a long time. So a couple years.
Yes. When you play some music or you have your students play, do they stand back to show you their body language as they play?
Well, we have to keep adjusting. You know, I figured out where to put my computer and my screen and how to, like, I wouldn't give a music lesson with the complicated background you're seeing right now, because you have to see the instrument more clearly. And but, you know, the students can usually, I say, just, you know, tip your screen so I can see your left hand. Okay, tip it so I can see your other hand. I mean, it's not ideal. You can't play music simultaneously. There are people who are working on that, but it's not doable as far as I know right now. So that's hard.
Each of these little stamps in which we have our talking head in the Zoom doesn't really show the whole body language, does it? You've gesticulated somewhat, so I do see your arms working, but we really don't get the body language anymore. We lose something, I think, of the person's whole performance.
That's what they say. They say that there's probably going to be some long-term communication change or damage, you know, from not being in person with people.
Yes. A certain stiltedness, I would imagine, in some cases, when you have three or four people.
I'll tell you what is hard for me is you can't interrupt.
Sorry that I did once in a while there by lighting up my little stamp. Yeah.
I do it too.
Yeah, we do. It's something that we can deal with through the editing. I would imagine Steve will do something. The one poem that I enjoyed also is the choosing which dessert to eat.
Oh, yes.
The potluck. We're going to many of those lately.
Right. Let me read that one. Basically, this is a real life situation, right, that anybody might find themselves in once if they were ever going to potlucks. There's a dessert table and it's covered with, you know, everything, and you can't eat everyone. I mean, or you probably would be wise if you didn't eat everyone. So how are you going to pick? So I actually have personal rules for myself about how to decide what to eat at a potluck. And so basically in this poem, I just tried to define what my rules were. And now, so it's an advice poem. And now don't take any of it. Just don't go to any potlucks at all. And don't share utensils. But you know, should it ever happen again, this is what you can do. All right. Choosing which dessert to eat at a potluck. Everything in it must count double, as love and lumpy, laminate and envelope, as not only work, but also tools. The butter as butter as butter, plus minimum driblets of water. Must count as autumn crisp, bygone, revived though hanging by a small orchard. Must count as party and pearmain, the joy as joy, as core as the copse by the berry, as bumble asking if this dessert distills the dream rushed through. And where was I the whole time? Yes, I did begin by freezing the fat, small dice every word. In sugar, the sad sack cherries weep their juice. To macerate is to round the flavors and also to wear away the soft parts of. Must count as slumpy, replumped in the heat, pressed up in the crust. And so must this evening's ruckus stack triple layers, birthday and fruit, book of flake. Don't eat what's put out in a plastic box. It counts only once, and who brought it's unknown. They entered the room, set it down, walked in toward the talking. May still be talking in this room somewhere, or else they left early. Their having left early would count their crumb extra, but from the plastic tray on the table, from who remains, jawing or scooping up with their fingers the last goopy piece at this time of night, we can't ever know.
Yes, very, very interesting. Brings to mind things that we have somewhat forgotten over the last 3 months.
Well,
but yes,
yeah.
There's no double dipping there, but reference to many, many other aspects of the life around a potluck.
Well, I will say that there's many people not in this world anymore who have left early. So it's kind of that, I guess the poem you know.
Yes. Yes.
About that. Really, and yeah. I was, of course, thinking about friends of mine through the years who've left early. And
that's right. Yes, the dessert table of life, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
When you used to lose the nozzles all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Was that your experience at one time in your life?
Oh, I don't even know.
Biographical or was that so made up?
I couldn't tell you. I mean, I grew up in a house with a garden. I think the line just came to me when I was, you know, in present time. We used to, it's even hard to say, it's sort of a tongue twister line. We used to lose our nozzles all the time. And then you know how when you say words over and over again, they get so, they turn into nonsense, like nozzle. What's a nozzle? We used to use our, you know, and of course it's the thing you stick on the end of a hose, but it's, what is it? Anyway, so I was just
it's trying to figure. It's very close to a nose, I think.
A nose.
Something close to a nose.
Nose. It also makes me think of noodle, like your head. But who knows what it is?
Who knows what the nozzle means, right?
Did I read that one? I guess I was trying to read
it. If you've got it handy, it's a very, I think it's a topical one, given the way people are taking care of their gardens.
And
wondering where or what kind of shoot is going to come out of the nozzle when they turn it on.
Right, yes. Yeah, so I guess you could say, yeah, so anyway, I'll just read it. We used to lose our nozzles all the time. We used to lose our nozzles all the time. Front yard, backyard, one hose end, so much another. When our summer dime to mist the neighbors fizzled, or our dig to plant the dead caved in. Come, you stains and sputters, Mom was calling, so we dropped them, womp, in their little dirt footprints, dinner a spray of crumbs and melted butter. We dipped, and dipped so well. Just then, someone changed the subject. Someone went to college. Some one of us seemed older, so we stood aside and never invented the rest. Our stories had wanted to invent themselves, but all we gave them for matter was minutes and pulses of heat. We wanted to give them a good night's sleep, but all night swayed for a theme. When we tried to soak deeply, we sluiced the dirt to the driveway to dry like waves we'd sweep and wreck. There'd been a dial for fan, shower, jet. Center dug up roots. Gentle was never enough. Took so long, we stopped before full slake, and later, so many shrubs it could be under.
Right.
It did sound to me as though it had been something that you had lived, maybe in your family. You know, this mention of someone went to college, someone of us. And poems often can come from one's life, right? They are things of life, and your life is going to be poured into it one way or another. If not your mind.
Yeah. That in particular, it's just very general. I went to college before my brother because I'm older. So it wasn't a sibling situation. There weren't really kids in the neighborhood. And it's kind of a made-up community, I guess.
I'd like to hear something from your other poems that you suggested earlier.
Yeah.
From your books. Would you like to change to something that you wrote some time ago in another life?
Oh yeah, definitely other lives. Yeah, it's funny about books. I look at it, I go, oh yeah, I wrote that. I did make up this word, but I found out later that it has also been made up by some kind of video game company, and there's some kind of game called that. But my reason is you can make a lot of words out of it. There's a lot of poems in the book that start with my this, my that, my this, my that, which was sort of a prompting idea for me. And it also has theory, so I went, oh, this is like the theory of identity, my theory. There's a lot in it about parents, about mother and father, and what are those figures, and they're really like the huge gods of your life. I'll read the first poem in the book, which is actually kind of different from all the others. So Bloomery. We made a furnace of dirt, threw dirt in. When it was done, dug dirt out. Dirt necklace, dirt needle, dirt knife, dirt bone, dirt button, dirt pot. Dirt babies, crying dirt cries. We fed them dirt milk, wrapped them warm in dirt blankets, boiled dirt kettles to keep their dirt diapers clean. On their dirt birthdays, gave them dirt bears. Dirt bedtime, read them dirt geese. When they left for dirt school, dirt grammar, dirt math, dirt art, dirt lunch, we wrote in our dirt journal, dirt alone at the dirt kitchen table, each day another dirt day. At their dirt weddings, dirt cake, dirt fizz, and home to our own dirt bed. When we were dirt old, we locked our dirt house and went to the forest, dug a dirt furnace, climbed in until dirt was done.
From the probiotic age of all things dirt.
Right, yeah.
My grandmother used to say to me, where there's dirt, it's good for you.
Ah, that's good. So a bloomery is a place where you smelt ore, you throw ore in and then you try to get iron out. So I was at a music festival one time and just chatting with a guy and, you know, you go like, what do you do? What do you do? And he said, oh, I dig holes in the ground and I throw dirt in and then I pull dirt out. And I went, what? And then he explained, he's like, part of this, there's a whole community of metal worker people who work to try to recreate early methods of smelting and early methods of forging. So he was trying to like, what are the kinds of smelting fires and holes and furnaces that Iron Age people would have tried to use. So anyway, but I just went, well, that's a line. I throw dirt in, I get dug dirt out. And then the word dirt was so cool. I just thought, well, why don't I just try to repeat the word dirt as many times as I possibly can. So that's what happened.
I want to thank you very much, Molly. It really has been enjoyable hearing your poetry, but also hearing about your daily life and certainly the life of your interesting grandparents. That was really something else.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. Thank you very much for coming today and participating in our interviews.
Well, thank you very much for asking me, and I look forward to hearing more interviews with other people that we do. So thank you.